From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once there was Hershey's chocolate, a creamy, bland bar for pocket change. Today, forget about it. The exploding cutting edge of chocolate is not creamy, not bland, and not cheap. It's deep, dark, sharp, complex, intense, and very close to the bean. Extreme chocolate. New Yorker writer and gourmand Bill Buford has been on chocolate safari deep in the rainforest among the fanatics, even in the beans. This hour On Point will be tracking and tasting extreme chocolate from Madagascar to Brazil with our gustatory guide, Bill Buford. We're going to be taste testing some of the best extreme chocolate today and learning about the history and the booming market in the high cacao stuff with a man who knows. Joining me from New York is Bill Buford, staff writer and in-house gastronome at the New Yorker magazine and author of the best-selling Heat and Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. His article, Extreme Chocolate, appears in the current issue of the New Yorker. Bill Buford, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back.
Last time we talked, you'd just come out of a Tuscan kitchen. Now you're in a vat full of beans. What got you off in chocolate country?
I'm always getting into trouble in some kind of things. I did. It was actually when I was working at Babbo, working on the book for Heat, that I had an experience not unlike Frederick Schilling's. Frederick Schilling is the founder of the organic chocolate maker Dagoba, where back there in the pastry kitchen, you see pastry cooks working with chocolate, and you suddenly realize this thing is much more complex and sophisticated than I ever realized. And there's tempering, and the sugars never dissolve in it, and you take it to one temperature and it does one thing and it falls apart and it's got these furious fats. And then there's all this business of the health benefits, and it suddenly became this is a mysterious, appealing, complex thing. And I contacted Schilling, and the adventure started from there.
You know, I've got an incredible array of extreme chocolates arrayed before me here. We're going to taste some of them. We're going to go with you, with your narrative, into the Brazilian rainforest and beyond. But, Bill, just lay the big picture out here for us for a second. What is going on with chocolate? And what's up with this? What does extreme chocolate mean? And what's happening with its popularity, with tastes and prices in chocolate?
Something has happened in the last 11 years. And, in fact, I think the crucial date is 1996. In 1996, Scharfenberger started, and they were the first American chocolate maker to put the cacao content, the actual percentage of Prima Matera, on the wrapper of the bar. And it said the cacao content matters.
So what's in this wrapper that's not milk, that's not cream, that's not lactin?
Not sugar,
that's not
preservative, that's not
straight ahead cacao.
It's just straight bean. And when you look at that, that's all it is, straight bean. Sometimes they'll add cacao butter to it. Sometimes they'll add vanilla. Sometimes they'll add a little bit of soy lectin to help it hold its shape. But it's basically pure bean and sugar, and that's what that percentage is.
What's the mystique around pure bean? What's it matter?
It's getting closer to a pure chocolate experience. What people realize that is over the course of the 20th century, chocolate is really more of a confection and a dessert and a sweet. It's perfectly good. It's just that the cacao content is often quite small, and there are other things in it, and there are creams, and there's fats, and there's milks, and they're good, but they're not necessarily good for you, and they're not getting you close to the real, pure, complex experience of chocolate. It doesn't mean that's necessarily what you want to have, but if you're interested in that kind of experience of this complex plant, this food, chocolate, then the cacao content is an indicator. It's an indicator of what you're about to get. Also in that same year, 1996, was when Lancet published its study that revealed that cacao has a 40-gram bar of chocolate has more antioxidants than like four times more of the red tea, twice the amount of green tea, three times the amount of black tea, and in fact has more antioxidants than any other food that we know. Now, we don't know what to do with that exactly, but it's sort of from that moment on, everything has changed. And so that now dark chocolate, serious dark chocolate, complex dark chocolate, sort of single source dark chocolate has become this huge craze. And while the chocolate industry itself is quite flat and has even been declining in recent years, dark chocolate has just gone, you know, to mix metaphors, it's gone completely bananas.
A kind of wonder bar here. I want to get a little of the history of this. We're going to get straight into that dark chocolate, the pure stuff. But if you go back in history, I mean, it wasn't always the case that people in, I don't know, what we call the Western world, Europeans, let's say, had any idea of chocolate. They came across it way, way, way back. I've got a bar that relates to the Aztecs and Montezuma here, the Aztec emperor. Give us some of the history, Bill. How did people who didn't grow up with in the part of the world where this was hanging off trees get to know chocolate?
This is a great thing. You're referring to Dagoba's Chocolato, which is Frederick Schilling's homage to the original Mesoamerican preparation of the bean. The bean is actually one of the oldest cultivated foods in the world. It grew wild in the Amazon. It sort of migrated its way, cross-pollinating up through Central America. And then it was only the Mesoamerican cultures, first the Olmecs on the Gulf Coast, and then the Mayans, and then finally the Aztecs, who knew what to do with the bean. And they fermented it, dried it, roasted it, made a drink out of it. So then it was finally discovered by Spanish explorers, first Columbus on behalf of the Spanish crown in 1502, and he had no idea what he'd come across. And then finally, Cortez, when he attending an Aztec feast, this food had been prepared, cultivated, and eaten for 3,000 years. Right. So the first time a European ever saw the thing, it had already been a food for 3,000 years. It was a very, very, very sophisticated food. It had a whole culture around it. It had goddesses of fertility. It seemed to be related to sex.
You described 1519, Cortez marches into the middle of Mexico, sits down to dinner, and here's this amazing thing. In Montezuma, the Aztec emperor is drinking it all night long, 50 cups a day for the Aztec.
According to one and possibly not entirely reliable Spanish observer who was writing his memoirs when he was in his doddering 80s, yes, there is a recollection that he had 50. I mean, there's no, you know, it's a diuretic as well. There's no account of him getting up to pee all the
time. Watch out
for
the revenge, yeah.
But he had all these doting women who, in sort of this great reverence, were bringing him lacquered gourds full of a preparation that. What they did in the Aztec preparation was, because they didn't mix it, they pour it from one vessel up high into another vessel and then back into the other vessel and back and forth until it created this foam mixed in with chilies and vanillas and kind of nutmegs and maybe some sweet. Usually it wasn't sweet, and it was usually served cold. And that's what this bar, this Chocolato, is an homage to. It's one of the first – in fact, I think it is the first dark chocolate that is made with chilies. And it tries to include some of the original Aztec ingredients and includes nibs. And nibs are the pure bean itself.
Okay. Let's Bill Buford, let's eat some chocolate like it's 1519 here.
All right.
And this is this Dagoba bar. We'll talk more about that and the other companies here in here. But this is dark chocolate, and it's got a ton of cacao, 74%. But it's chocolate, chilies, and nibs. And what are nibs again?
Nibs are the You have the cacao seed, and then it's dried, and it becomes a bean.
Okay.
And then you have the shell, and the shell's rather tricky to get off. And the heart of the bean is usually breaks up in the winnowing, and that's called a nib.
Okay.
So a nib is like the pure bean itself. So this is flavored with the pure bean.
Chilies. Well, it tastes like – it chews like chocolate. Oh, well, there's the chili. Oh, my God. It's got a
little
bite to it.
A little heat in the back there.
Yeah. Talk about heat. Yeah, so this is not the pure stuff, but this is like juiced with the chili bean.
Yeah,
intense chocolate and that sharp edge of the chili. I don't know if Montezuma's favorite is going to fly off the shelves at Walgreens.
In fact, it turns out it's an incredibly popular bar. And it's been imitated by other makers as well.
Hey, if you like Tex-Mex, if you like it hot, if you like the hot sauce, you'll like this one.
But this is very close probably to what the Aztecs were preparing. And this is very close to when Cortez and all his troops were attending this first feast. And they saw this weird exotic preparation of this chocolate drink. This is something of the flavors that they would have had. And this is what it had a great mystique to them. Cortez himself evidently didn't like it, but other people did, and eventually they started coming back to Spain.
When did Europeans begin to eat chocolate in any significant degree, and how, and what was it like?
The first official import that we know about was one that arrived in Sevilla in 1565. Got a little heat there.
No, look, I'm still there.
It's going to take a while to get around. Okay. I suggested this might have been the thing we should have had last.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes, how it affects the rest of us.
1665, did you say?
1565.
Okay.
And at that time, it was very expensive because it was this exotic bean. And it was also very expensive because the Spaniards had been so effective at decimating the Aztecs that there weren't many people around to cultivate the bean.
Great.
And it was the first time that it was served warm. And it was served with sugar. And that was the beginning of the kind of flavor combinations that we associate with chocolate. The European found it way too bitter and wanted some sugar. And also from the very beginning, I think the model was probably coffee. The Europeans wanted to add milk to it. And it never quite worked. It never quite mixed. But for the next four centuries, they kept trying to add milk to it. Tendo coração vazio,
vivo assim, anda piscinho, sabia, vem cá também. We're talking this hour about extreme chocolate and the booming craze for the most exotic chips off the cacao plant. Bill Buford is my guest, New Yorker staff writer, great gourmand, author of Heat most recently, and now a big article, Extreme Chocolate, taking us right into the rainforest and beyond. I should say, you can go to our website and see a bunch of the chocolates that we're going to try and taste in this hour. They've got a lot of beautiful, very pure bars laid out in front of me here. I want to thank Chocosphere.com for getting them to us. And also a thanks to Valrhona and Scharfenberger and Dagoba happen to be some who got us some chocolate here. If you've got other brand names, we're happy to put them straight out there. That's what it's about today. Bill Buford, introduce us to two guys who are at the heart of your story. One, you mentioned Frederick Schilling, and the other, who we may hear from in just a minute here, Diego Badaro, chocolate maniacs, each in their own way. Introduce us.
Well, Frederick is the founder of Dagoba Chocolates, an organic manufacturer and one of the first serious manufacturers in America. Started in 2001, been in business for 6 years, huge success story, and has recently been bought by Hershey's. He's himself a kind of fanatic for the rainforest and trying to get to discover new beans and connect to the farmers.
Okay.
And one of them is Diego. And Diego's like some sort of patriarch in training who's walked out of a South American novel. I have never met a man like Diego. His family was among the first growing cacao, the cacao tree and fruit, in this very particular area of Brazil called Bahia.
Mm-hmm. Northeast.
It's a rainforest. Mm-hmm. It's not the Amazon. It's actually on the fringe, the northeast fringe of Brazil. And they started planting cacao there in 1850, right around the time when the whole world had this need for chocolate. Mm-hmm. And by the time that Hershey's, in fact, opened its factory in 1905, the place was berserk. Chocolate was really it was the gold of the region. Mm. And Diego comes from that line of chocolate producers.
But Bill, stand by in New York. We've got Diego Badaro with us right now. He's not at the family plantation in Bahia. He joins us today on the run, just about to get on a flight at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, of all things. Diego Badaro, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
What's happening with the chocolate market? You're the plantation owner. How are tastes changing? What do people want today that they didn't maybe 10, 20 years ago?
Today, the consumption market is directing to high percentages of cocoa, more origin chocolate, organic, fair trade products, and we are on it.
And describe your family plantation for us. It's on the banks of the Rio de Contas in the Bahia rainforest. How big is it? How much cacao do you produce?
It's a beautiful plantation, has 150 hectares. Besides the Rio de Contas, it's a river full of diamonds. Underneath the water, it's a beautiful plantation with a huge forest, thick forest, virgin. We produce 15 tons in that plantation.
And are you selling to guys like Frederick Schilling and Dagoba? Do you sell all over the world? Where?
All over the world. Europe, U.S., to Frederick. Frederick is a great partner of us.
Now, Bill Buford, describe the moment.
Pleasure.
Bill, in New York, describe for us the moment, if you would, when you were down in this rainforest with Schilling and Diego, who's with us right now from Paris, and the three of you all ended up naked in a vat of fermenting cacao beans. What's up with that?
It was probably the highlight of our life, wouldn't you agree, Diego? three men rolling around in a vat of hot fermenting cacao beans.
I've heard of strange steam baths, but what were you looking for in there, Bill?
Well, actually, you know, it's fermentation of the cacao bean is one of the weirdest food preparations in the world, and one of the things really is you just want to get the beans really, really hot. You want to make sure all the beans are fermenting, and traditionally, someone jumps in and rolls the beans around to make sure the ones on the bottom are getting to the top, the ones on the top are getting to the bottom. What I hadn't realized is that the guy who normally does it wears plastic boots and rain-protective clothing. And I just thought he'd jump in, you know, naked without his shoes on. And it was just a misunderstanding. I just hopped in and just wanted to see what it was like. It was hot, and I found that out. Also, Diego's thermometer wasn't working, so it was probably really, really hot.
You're lucky.
Also, his alarm that's meant to go off when it gets really, really hot, that wasn't working either. So yeah. Who knows how hot it was.
You're lucky to get out alive. Diego Badaro, what's the magic of the purest, darkest chocolate? How do you describe it, the effect, the flavor?
It's complexity. It's all on it. The earth, the forest, the rain, the animals, the enchanting. Everything is inside that dark chocolate, this magic. Chocolate's a passion, it's a magic for us.
And what about the effect on the body? We've heard about the antioxidants there, but is there a physical effect that you can describe as a planter?
Yes, it retards the aging, and it's like a boost. When we eat chocolate, I used to eat the beans when I go walking in the forest, and I can walk the whole day without stopping and eating other things, just eating chocolate and give us pleasure, energy. It's a sacred food for us.
Do you feel the connection that still goes back all the way to Montezuma, the Aztecs, the ritual there?
Totally, totally. We grew up, we take care of the tree like the old ancients.
Diego Badaro at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. We don't get you on your plantation, but we get the genuine article anyway, and we're grateful to you for being with us.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine. Ciao, Bill.
Bon voyage,
New York.
Bon voyage.
Bon voyage. Thanks, Diego. Thanks very much. Bill Buford, take us to that same plantation, and maybe we should start to break out some more of this chocolate while we do it.
We have a little bit of Madagascar while we invoke the rainforest. Diego made a number of comments which are kind of very loaded and evocative, and one of which is that he said when he eats chocolate, he tastes, you know, the rainforest and the animals, and what he's alluding to is the cacao exists naturally in the rainforest, and it exists naturally in a place of extreme biodiversity. And the extreme biodiversity is what sort of produces a lot of the intense flavors of the chocolate. It reproduces only when an animal breaks up the pod, and the seeds get out. If the seeds are left in the pod, they shrivel up and die. The seed lands on the rainforest floor, and then it is assaulted by hundreds of predators and invaders and bacteria. But it protects itself against them, and in that extreme protection, is the extreme complexity of the flavors of pure cacao.
Now the pod is pretty good size. I look at the photograph here; it's sort of almost football size in shape.
It's almost football size
with a lot of pulp around the beans inside, and you described spitting is very important here because those beans don't taste good when the animals first snuffle around on them. They're going to spit them out in a hurry.
When you break up the pod, what you get is a liqueur and the pulp, and it's very, very sweet. It has sort of citrus notes. It's a little bit like lychee. I thought a little bit of grapefruit in there as well, and you just want to drink it up and suck it up, and it's the thing that gets apes, birds, monkeys, rats, whatever, to identify the pod as something on a tree that they want to rip off, break open, and slurp up until they get to the seed, and then they spit it out.
Okay, we'll get to a Brazilian rainforest chocolate. We've got one here from Madagascar, also very hot. And now I've got Montezuma's chocolate out with some oyster crackers and water here. I'm purged. I'm ready to go on with this one. But there's a whole sort of technique to tasting fine chocolate. Instruct me, please, Bill.
There is. I have to admit, I don't entirely buy it. A lot of the chocolate makers, they give you the 6-page instructions and you're meant to break it and listen to the snap and smell it. And can. You can. You know, Demory's got a long website. You can study for a long, long time to see if you're deserving enough for this expensive chocolate that you've bought. But mainly, you bite it and it's
done.
The principal thing is cacao fat. Mm-hmm. Cacao fat melts at a temperature very close to the body temperature, so the chocolate immediately melts in your mouth. There's a reason why M&M came up with that slogan. Mm. And in that melting, the flavors start to dissolve, and you should get quite a great deal of complexity. Mm. Now, this one is different from the other one we had before.
And this is Ampa Makia from the Milot Plantation, Madagascar.
This is one of Valrhona's Madagascar bars. Mm-hmm. Madagascar has is become renowned for a certain kind of fruity cacao.
Yeah.
And in this, you really feel like you're tasting something which is a fruit. And it's very different from the last one we had.
Very. And it starts off with that familiar chocolate sheen, and then the fruit just comes bursting through that flavor.
The fruit is astonishing. It's why the Madagascar chocolates are so popular. And it's just, you know, the trouble with this is that once you start eating it, it's very hard to stop.
Now, this one's just 64% cacao. Some of these others that I've tasted, you can't just keep eating them. They're too intense, but this one you could.
Yes, and actually Valrhona is very interesting because they were the first to do a 70% bar. They sort of crossed the sound barrier of the higher chocolate with their Guananja, which is the bar named after the island where Columbus first saw a cacao bean. Mm. But actually a lot of their chocolates are a little bit under 70%. Just because they're sort of balancing out sort of fruits with sweets and the intensity of the cacao. This is made from a different bean from what we had before. Mm. I think most of the beans from Madagascar is a bean called the Trinitario. And the Trinitario is a cross of – there are basically only two beans. There's the bean that the Mayans and the Aztecs domesticated. Mm-hmm. And then there's the bean in its sort of rugged, dark, wild self, which comes from Brazil. And the Amazon. And the domesticated one is called a criollo, which is a Spanish for sort of like the local bean.
Yep.
And the original one is called a forastero, which just means the newcomer. That's only because they discovered it later. They crossbred them in Trinidad to create a Trinitario. And they crossbred them because there was a giant storm in the 18th century which obliterated all the trees, and they had to plant forastero there. And this particular flavor comes from that crossbreeding. Transplanted to Madagascar, and it's a beautiful, beautiful flavor.
Madagascar, 64% cacao and fruit like crazy. We'll go to Trinidad for one in just a second here, but let me begin to hear from our listeners as well. Let's get a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I eat the raw chocolate beans straight out of the bag. I buy them Whole Foods, USDA organic. But what I'm really looking for is provenance of the beans. It doesn't tell me anywhere where they come from. I get a real energy boost from them, and I eat them right in the car when I'm driving around. I've been doing it for probably over a year now.
Energy boost? You must be bouncing off the ceiling of the car. I mean, don't they kind of give you that sort of caffeine kick?
Well, yeah, they do, but I don't drink coffee much anymore. I'm more into, like, green tea and things like that. But the coffee, the chocolate beans themselves, I love. And I'm also a big fan of Hershey products as well. I'm less into the sugar and more into the bitterness of the bean I really like. And I buy the ones that don't have the skin on them.
Yeah.
So some of them have a little bit of a skin on it.
Yeah, I'm looking at them here. They look about sort of almond, sort of like a big gnarly almond.
Yeah, you just crush them up. I eat like four or five at a time, and even my daughter will eat one or two. She's 2.5. She's not really into the bitter taste.
Talk about taking it straight. Bill, what do you say to that? Is that going to catch on? Are we going to be popping cacao beans, cocoa beans?
I like the idea of feeding it. I have 2-year-olds at home. I have twins. I'm going to try that tonight. I think it's a great idea.
Oh, boy, go wild.
That'll get them cranking.
Yeah.
I have to admit, with Diego, I discovered the bean, and I haven't looked back, and it completely changed my attitude. I started with Diego's beans, which are mainly forastero, but there's a lot of interbreeding, and you can usually tell. Once you get to know them, you can tell what kind of bean it is from the color. The forasteros are very dark and black, and the criollos are quite blonde. Mm. And there's one called a porcelana, which is very, very blonde. It's like a sort of a highly domesticated Mesoamerican bean. Mm. I was eating them with Diego, just trying to locate all the complex flavors of chocolate, which you really do get in the bean. When suddenly, I don't know, 8-10 beans in, I wasn't even thinking about it. Suddenly, I just got this full, unapologetic buzz.
That's right.
And it It was different from a caffeine buzz, mm-hmm. which evidently isn't that – the content isn't that high. It's theobromine. And it's probably the combination of caffeine and theobromine. And
theobromine. This is the food of the gods, I guess, if you take it back to the original.
Theobromine is an alkaloid. Caffeine is an alkaloid. Mm-hmm. Nicotine is an alkaloid. Strychnine is an alkaloid. An alkaloid is a plant defense to keep it from being eaten up by all these predators around it. But in moderate quantities, human beings tend to get off on alkaloids very often. And theobromine is the alkaloid that is unique to cacao. Linus named it Theo from the gods and Broma for food, food of the gods. And it's the unique alkaloid to chocolate. Scientists have taken all these elements in isolation and tested them, and they've said, you know, it doesn't really that significant. But I actually think the science in food and the science in chocolate in particular is way, way, way behind the times. Scientists don't get grants from any of the big national institutions. They've come to food long after people who make the food have known many, many things about it, and they only get their money from manufacturers generally.
More mysteries than we know there. Let's take a bite of this
more.
Trinidad bar here. We've got an Antilles bar. It's called from Scharfenberg. And this is 75% cacao. You say cocoa, I say cacao, or vice versa. Does it matter? Is it all the same word?
In the English language, it doesn't matter. But in any other language, people, when they use the word cocoa, it refers to a drinking powder.
Mm-hmm.
And the drinking powder was developed by a Dutch chemist in 1828, and that's the word he came up for it. In the English language, there's been a great confusion about what to call this thing because the word came to them from the Spanish, and the Spanish itself came from the Aztec, and there's a great mess. And it's used interchangeably. You'll see the fat is called cocoa butter, and that goes back to the 1828 discovery of the chemist who separated cocoa butters and the solids to make drinking chocolate.
And what about this bar, Bill, this Antilles? It's origins out of Trinidad and Grenada and Dominican Republic, coastal Venezuela here. 75%. This is getting pretty intense.
I think this is an amazing bar.
Chili.
I remember when I ate it with Frederick, and he tasted it and he said, "Expensive beans. These are very, very special beans from Trinidad. You would get the Trinitario. From the Dominican Republic, you're probably getting a Forastero. From Venezuela, you're probably getting the native bean that they call the Nacional from there. And you're basically in this bar." Getting the trendiest, fruitiest beans that you can, that are out there, all mixed together in one bar, and it's a fabulous bar. It's a very
terrific.
Nice successor to the Valrhona bar.
We're talking this hour about extreme chocolate and the booming craze for the most exotic chips off the cacao plant. Bill Dupert is with us. Extreme Chocolate, his piece in New York this week. He went on kind of chocolate safari to Brazil and beyond. The percentage of straight-up bean in these bars is getting really high, off the charts. So are the prices. Some of them $100+ per pound for this chocolate. But it is really going places. Bill, let's go straight to – we've got a 100% cocoa mass bar here. This I've never done. I'm sure you have. Sambirano, it's called. Sambirano from the Domori is the maker.
This is another one out of. Brace yourself. Brace yourself.
Okay. I'm just getting into it as a challenge. It's like Fort Knox here.
I think the Sambirano is another Madagascar bean.
Yeah.
But this, we had a Valrhona before.
Yeah.
And this is the Madagascar bean all by itself. Nothing else.
No sugar, no milk, no you name it. This is just. Okay, here we go. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
100% cacao mass or cocoa mass.
Who's going to? I don't know. I'm not a big enough fan, Bill. It's hard to swallow. Do you eat this for fun?
This one, I have to admit, I'm not a big fan of this, but it's because I think this is over-refined.
You mentioned
that it's hard to swallow. There's I love some of the 100% bars. You can't eat them much. You really do treat them like a food. It's very close to eating the bean. For me, this one has been over-refined.
Serious chocolate maker. What does it mean, over-refined?
It's a process called conking, where it's like a bath, like a conch shell, and the chocolate is just really sort of slushed back and forth. And in the process, the cacao solids and the sugars start to break down, and you get a more and more refined chocolate, but there's a point where it gets too refined, and it's too refined for even the palate to pick up.
It's
and
like I think a super, super intense espresso or something there.
This for me is kind of gummy, and it's a little hard to swallow. I think this is actually too refined.
You've got to be a true believer to go with that, but people are and do.
DeGoba makes 100% cacao bar, which actually I love, and I can't get enough of. It's called Prima Materia, and that one hasn't been refined as much, and you've got much more complexity. But this is you have a pretty intense mouthful there. It's coming from one bean.
No
it's
kidding.
One flavor. It's from the Trinitario. It's coming from one area, Madagascar. And they've worked it very, very hard. These are the people,
100%.
If I remember correctly, these are the people who also do a Porcelana. These are the ones who sell chocolate at more than $100 a pound. And they're into a very high-end thing. And
I tasted that yesterday, the Porcelana. That was pretty good, but this one is just a little bit beyond my range. You would not
extreme.
Sit around eating that all night, at least, I don't know, not at my table. Megan's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Megan. You're on the air with Bill Buford.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
To answer your question that you just said before the as the break came out, yes, dark chocolate has completely changed the way that I eat chocolate.
How?
I think that because it's so much better, and it you change the way you eat it. You can only eat a small piece at a time. You can't just eat a whole bar or a whole bag of something, which for dietary concerns is much better.
Right. I mean, this 100% stuff anyway, but I don't know. Some people could get onto one of those 64% bars and go pretty crazy. But yeah, it's not a volume experience, is it?
It's definitely not a volume. It's taste. It's savoring the entire piece. My favorite's about 80-85%. I think that's, it still has some of the sweetness, but it's got just enough of the bitterness to really make it enjoyable.
That's true. And a question for Bill Buford there, Megan?
Because of dark chocolate and because I personally haven't looked back, but I'm curious what he thinks about white chocolate. I haven't even touched milk chocolate since dark chocolate really came to the storefront, but I'm really curious what he thinks about white chocolate.
Is white chocolate chocolate, or is that just a phrase?
It is chocolate. It's it goes back again to this Dutch chemist in 1828 who figured out how to separate the fats from the solids. One of the features of chocolate is that it's very fat. Now, it's not the kind of fat that hurts you, and there seems to be an argument that it's one of the fats that's good for you, like oleic acid that you find in olive oil and avocado. But it's about 55% fat. That was one of the reasons why it never mixed in liquid, and it never made a good drink. It always it was always very silty and full of just never mixed properly. And why the Aztecs had to do this whole ritual of pouring it from one vessel to another. And Van Houten is the person who pressed out the chocolate with a big press, and the fats came out, and what was left were the solids that dried out, and he made a cocoa drink. The cocoa butter is the fat, and when you take that out, that's the principal ingredient of white chocolate.
So if you want the real fat stuff, you've got it right there.
What people tend to do, though, is they mix cocoa butter by itself is a little hard for most people, so they mix it with cocoa butter and milk and sugar, and it's really comparable to it's like another milk chocolate confection. It does have an integrity, though, because it does come from cocoa butter.
But we're in the opposite direction here today. Really dark, dark, dark. Let's go to Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Bill. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Hey, I am a big chocolate eater. I work with USA Track and Field and do coaches clinics around the country and work with universities. And a lot of the top track coaches and running coaches will actually teach that chocolate is a great recovery, dark chocolate after a hard workout.
So you're pushing dark chocolate for athletes, for top-tier athletes. What's it do for them? Bob, how does it – I mean, they're restored by a chocolate bar? I can imagine energy-wise, but what else? I don't know if we've got Bob there.
I think Bob put his question and then fell off. He went off to get some more chocolate. I don't blame him. He's exhausted.
Okay.
You know, that's actually very interesting, though, because in the history of chocolate, it has often been a food for troops. It was given to soldiers by the Aztecs. It was made into a hard bar by the Spaniards. It was used throughout the European wars. And it was sort of the big boost even for Hershey's in the 20th century. But basic chocolate has that quality that Diego was describing, is that you can take some beans and you can go for a long walk and the fats and the proteins will sustain you and carry you. And a lot of the farmers down in Brazil, they eat nothing else during the day except the bean. And it has a combination of fat, protein, and energy. And it has been conventionally and historically used for people under physical stress for millennia.
Interesting. So it's not just a taste of home. It actually keeps those guys marching or farming or running in Bob's case.
And this is another area where I think like the people who make the food at the moment and the people who have been eating the food for centuries know more about the food than science does yet. And science is just finally finding a way in.
I guess so. Let's go to Annie in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Annie. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you. Hello, Tom and Bill. And I'm appreciated learning a lot more than I knew before about the science, the art, and the culture of chocolate.
Mm.
I love chocolate. I have heard, however, that I guess a majority or a double-digit percentage, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, of cacao beans globally are harvested by forced labor or child labor in some cases. And I guess I'm concerned as the world demand for chocolate grows and, you know, so many of us enjoy it, how do we enjoy it responsibly and how do we encourage the right kind of production as a global product?
That is a great question, and let us pick it up. Bill, Annie's got this sort of free trade, fair trade, you know, non-exploitive chocolate question, and I'm also looking here at a headline talking about sort of the equivalent of blood diamonds, you know, saying after diamonds and timber, a group called Global Witness says that chocolate out of the Ivory Coast, is in their sights now, is contributing to funding and prolonging conflicts there. What about the fair trade, free trade, blood chocolate debate there?
It is a very, very big issue. You go right to the heart of the trouble. For a start, if you want to be eating responsibly, then you want to go with an organic maker like Dugobar. You want to go with these serious people who get their chocolate from small plantations, usually in Latin America, but not necessarily. I mean, the cacao from Madagascar and the Far East is also very special. But you want to go with somebody who just has a track record of working with the farmer and have long relationships with the farmer and will sustain that relationship by paying them a living wage.
How do you know if you're a consumer which maker that may be? I mean, just because it's organic, does that necessarily mean it's a kind of a...
Likelihood is that it will.
Okay.
Likelihood is it will, because the ones that are, just the way it falls out. I mean, in fact, most of these chocolates that we've been eating are not organic, but they've come from small makers and small farmers who can't afford pesticides and that you won't find pesticides in them.
Forced labor, child labor, that takes a little of the sheen off of a nice chocolate bar.
That refers to West Africa. We haven't had any West African chocolate here.
Mm-hmm.
And West Africa is the mysterious, difficult boom of chocolate making. It's why chocolate is cheap. Before chocolate was grown in West Africa in the Ivory Coast in 1905, it was extremely expensive. It's what made all the millionaires down in Bahia. Mm. Since then, chocolate is very, very cheap. The average wage, I think, is $35 a month in West Africa. There have been accusations of slave labor. They haven't been proven. There have been accusations of child labor. They are probably likely, but that's also probably because lots of families are involved in a subsistence living.
Mm.
They do a very exploitative kind of fast growth of the tree. The tree is not in the rainforest. It's out in a brutal sun. It does very high productive. It dies quickly. Shortcuts are taken in the drying of the bean and the fermenting of the bean. And generally, the flavor of most West African chocolate is inferior. If you're into serious chocolate, it's very rare that you'll ever have it, because most of it, even though it accounts for 80% of all the chocolate that's produced in the world, most of it goes into what's called a bagged product. It's the thin coating on a Snickers. It's it's part of the coating on an M&M. It's
so on
Easter
Halloween
egg.
We'll be moving a lot of that stuff.
Halloween, Easter. That's where you're getting your West African chocolate.
Annie, I hope that gives you some guidance, and thanks for your call. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont again, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I have a very positive chocolate story. My wife and I are clinical psychologists and teach out of the University of Vermont.
Great.
We teach a course in cross-cultural psychology down in Belize in Central America, and we travel down to the Toledo district and connect with the Maya Indians there. And a few years ago, Green and Black, which is a large organic company in England, did a fair trade deal with the Maya villages there, and they create a chocolate, I don't know whether Bill has ever had, called Maya Gold, which is really extraordinary, and it's made a tremendous impact on the economy of some very depressed people in
Belize. So it's working well for the farmers there.
Very well. Small farmers, it's growing.
Hey, while we've got you, clinical psychologist, what do you have to say about how chocolate works on our psychology?
Well, I think it's a real good thing. I mean, I think everything in moderation, of course, but the idea of kind of moving more towards the pure stuff and not needing to eat a lot of it and just really savoring it, it's a wonderful way of kind of bringing you into the present moment and the being mindful.
I love it. David, thank you very much. Bill, Maya Gold, you know it?
I do indeed. In fact, I spoke to the founder at great length about what they had done there. It's a fairly typical effort, characteristic of all these chocolate makers that we've been eating today, and most of the serious chocolate makers, who recognize that good chocolate is going to come from good cacao in the rainforest that has to be carefully prepared. Most of the flavor is actually achieved there in the rainforest in the fermentation and the drying. Mm. And the only way they're going to have a business is by developing a living, working relationship with these people so that they're making it in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. And you can taste it in the complexity of the flavor. Valrhona's got the same relationship. They haven't had sort of the miracle results necessarily that Green and Blacks have. But,
yeah. You know, I'm getting my appetite back with this view of cacao farming. I've got a Dagoba bar here. Milagros, it's called, Peruvian Amazon.
Yes.
Forastero bean.
This was interesting to me. Haven't had it since I've been in Brazil. I wanted to taste it because, unlike the others, this one is made from the Forastero. It's the original dark, more bitter bean, and it's from Peru. And you very rarely see chocolate from Peru. This is one of Schilling's discoveries.
It doesn't hit you over the head. It sort of comes on a little thinner at the beginning, and then the depth is behind. Very nice. Kind of a delicate flavor there. Really nice. Really nice.
Oh. I think that's a beautiful chocolate.
That is wonderful.
It's kind of not flashy, but you really feel like you're tasting real chocolate.
I've got a dangerous bar. Another one here from Dagoba. This is called Eros. Okay, what do we have here, Bill?
This is one of Schilling's more wacky experimentations. He's probably made more chocolate products, if I may use the generic word, than probably anybody in the history of the business. Valrhona will take years to produce a product, and then they test it in front of panels and send it to pastry chefs, and after 4 years of testing, they finally release it in one little region of the world. Frederick, he'll have an idea, and then he'll want to sell it at the end of the week, and then the next week he'll have five more ideas. And this is his idea of putting basically herbal aphrodisiacs in his chocolate mix, including one which I know has produced wild results at some parties that he's thrown. But what's playful and fun about it
flagrante
was indeed you're gonna have to read the New Yorker for that one. But what I like about it is that it's playing on the aphrodisiac legacy of chocolate, which scientists say don't exist. But
I'll
actually,
have another bite of that.
When you get into the bean, you think, and you find out what theobromine does, and you experience a bit of buzz, and you find out all the other chemical compounds in a cacao seed, and you think, there might be something in this. And I think I'm going to have a bar of this before I go to bed tonight.
A boysenberry and botanical infusion to awaken the heart. It tastes good, too. I think it's going to be a great day, Bill, with that under our belts. And maybe
we're
later,
well
too.
Today.
Wow. Awesome. Oh, that's terrific. Bill Buford, you've been such a great gustatory guy, as always, getting us out there in chocolate. Do you find yourself eating more or less chocolate now, Bill, that you've tuned in to the pure stuff?
Oh, I'm completely transformed. I eat it now every day. And like the one caller, I really love the beans. I love having some beans on hand. I have some beans with me here right now, in fact. And I'll have a little bit just every day, and I go through periods where the only thing I want is 100% bar, not the one that we had, but I like that intense, complex kick.
A lot of options, and what a beautiful world out there. Bill Buford with the New Yorker, thank you as always. It's been a real treat. Thanks.
It's been a treat for me.
Wonderful article, wonderful tour of the chocolate world. Bill Buford with the New Yorker magazine. His most recent book is Heat. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed it as well. You can see all the chocolates we've been tasting in this hour at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks to chocosphere.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.